When faced with known or new possible predators, our brains revert to fight or flight instincts. But today's film examines what happens when we actually take the time to investigate our perceived threats. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Man, oh man, oh man, was this Q&A a blast for me to do. I was so happy to have screenwriter Eric Heiserer join me for today's podcast, as his talented script yielded such a fantastic film that truly works as intelligent, four-quadrant science fiction, and four-quadrant entertaining storytelling. As a lifelong fan of intelligent sci-fi, one of the most important tests for it to pass in any form is to have the effect of provoking intelligent thought, discussion, and reflection. And Arrival is perfect in every one of those respects. Yet, as you'll hear, to achieve such a great story and rich characters took a lot of refinement on Eric's part, and he was great about explaining his entire process, so I know you'll dig this episode. And by the way, today's episode is sponsored by the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship, which is now taking fellowship script submissions. ScreenCraft will select up to four winners who will receive $1,000 each plus round-trip travel to Los Angeles for a week of mentorship and meetings with Hollywood agents, managers, producers, studio executives, and Oscar-winning screenwriters. Previous winners of the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship have gone on to sign with top management companies and agencies including Anonymous Content, Paradigm, CAA, 3 Arts Entertainment, and ICM. You can enter to win by submitting your original feature film or original TV pilot script at ScreenCraft.org before the final deadline of January 15th, 2017. Another cool thing to note is that this year's ScreenCraft mentors include Academy Award-winning writers and producers of Crash, Million Dollar Baby, Brokeback Mountain, Precious, Big Hero 6, and more. So hey, don't miss the January 15th deadline. Get all the details at ScreenCraft.org. And hey, I hope you'll also check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Remember, for you non-iPad folks, stay tuned to www.backstory.net for updates, because soon enough, it'll become the fully functional magazine. Issue 23 is our current issue. It's my Snowden issue. If you have an iPad, you're in for a real treat, as we have over 12,000 words regarding the making of Snowden from our three cover story articles, which include co-writer Kieran Fitzgerald, actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and co-writer-director Oliver Stone. So you are going to love digging through our in-depth coverage there. Plus, in issue 23, you could read comic book pieces, TV pieces, and an entire Blacklist screenplay to read, accompanied by an interview with the writer, and so much more. So I hope you check out issue 23. And hey, get ready. Issue 24 is right around the corner, right before Thanksgiving. It's our Manchester by the Sea cover, so I hope you'll keep an eye out for that. And just as we're ready to start the podcast, those of you with great scripts, don't forget to get your screenplay or pilot script submitted to the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship as well. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right onto the stage at the Los Angeles Film School at my sold-out screening right after I introduce screenwriter Eric Heiserer to discuss his latest film, Arrival. Thanks for coming down. I'm going to call up an almost 10-year-old to ask the first question tonight before he goes home. Oh, wow. So, Miles, come on up.
After reading the short story, how did you know that it would be a good movie?
That's a really good question. Honestly, I did not know. But I knew how it made me feel, and I was profoundly affected by it emotionally. And I thought, what a wonderful gift the story gave to me, and is there a way that I can gently lift this from the story and give it to an audience on film? I didn't think about how tough it would be to adapt, and I should have, but that was my thought.
All right, you got your answer. Miles, go home, get some
sleep.
Thank
you, Miles. Thanks.
Well, so, you know, as we're sitting here at the lovely Los Angeles Film School, I guess I just want to ask the first question is, did you go to film school? What kind of led you on the path towards film?
I did not. I didn't go to college at all. My father was a classics professor at University of Oklahoma. He did that for nearly 30 years. And at some point in time, in my senior year of high school, he pulled me aside and said, Eric, I can tell you're an autodidact, that you learn by like throwing yourself into something and breaking it and putting it back together. And I can tell you college is going to be so disappointing to you. And just go out there. It was like, it usually teaches you to do things that allows you to teach other people. It's like Amway with the track team. You don't need this. And I thought, wow, that was really observant of you, Dad. And I was talking to Mom about that years later, and she's like, oh, honey, we just didn't have any money. We couldn't afford anything. We just didn't get any money. We didn't. He just said that to try and get rid of you.
So the cheapest possible route cheapest was don't go to college.
And, right, not
you'll figure it all out.
He'll find it. I'm sure he'll swim. But honestly, he was right that I learned by doing, and I taught myself a whole bunch of Adobe software back when Photoshop had a 1.0. I'm an old man. And at that time, a lot of university curriculum hadn't caught up with a lot of the Macintosh publishing software. And so I found myself out of high school with the first real gig that I had outside of being like the roadie DJ to Rock 100 the Cat, you know, for various like sweet 16 birthday parties. Beyond that, I had a job at Space Industries and NASA down in Clear Lake, where I was the designer and basically page layout architect for these proposals that astrophysicists were making for technology for the astronauts to use. And that was a crazy gear shift for me. That was a crazy experience. They were doing like 75-hour weeks. And it was good because I knew nobody in Houston. You know, I just moved down there and spent my hours with these brainiacs there who would, you know, just feed me all the technical specs. And I'd come back and I'd say, guys, I can't make heads or tails of this. You got to think like I would. And if you're going to try and talk to a suit with this proposal, you know, here's some things that maybe we can make it look a little sexier. And the best part of that was whenever we got a proposal approved, man, I'm going on a tangent here, but
please,
when it happened, there would be a party. And, you know, at the party, it was, I wasn't even 21 yet, so I couldn't drink. So there would be a whole bunch of booze and ginger ale. And after about a couple of hours, being with drunk astrophysicists is like the funnest experience ever. It was just hilarious. It was just like, you know, Eric, if aliens invaded, this is how it'd go. You know, I had one guy's like, you don't send a nuke to an asteroid, you paint it white. The sun does everything for you. And I was like, what? What? Tell me, what was that? Come on, go back to that. You know, and
are you saying there's a better ending for Armageddon than
there
what
is.
We saw?
There is, it's all about using reflective like paint to just have it naturally get knocked off course.
Don't tell Steve Buscemi that. Well, that's amazing. Well, so, you know, when it comes to writing, I know that, and I know I'm going to pronounce this wrong, that you had a fictional letters via Dionea House.
You're right. Yes. Wow.
Pronounce it right though?
Dionea House. Yeah.
Dionea House. And it was kind of an online experiment of writing letters from a fictional fan to a fictional author and telling a story.
A little bit, yeah.
Via that process.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just kind of curious if you could talk us through what kind of gave you that idea and then how you got attention for it that led to further writing.
So the Wayback Machine, 2004, I move out here after getting a couple of things optioned for, you know, like pennies on the dollar, but it was enough. I'm like, all right, $10,000, I can make that last. Ramen noodles, here I come. And like immediately, 2 months after you're showing up here, both projects just completely fell apart, and I was hemorrhaging money, and so I needed to start cranking out material, and I was also in that horrible stage of like I knew nobody, and I began to find myself as a hermit, alone, just deciding that I had to write a number of pages before I was able to go out, and thought this is not a way to live, and so I took an invite to a friend's house, and as I drove there, I went by a house that looked exactly like a house in Houston that I used to drive by, like down to the roof damage. And that stuck in my brain. Like, what the heck is that? Why is that house here? And like some stories come to us, it's not one big great aha moment. It's like this weird osmosis. It's like a culmination of things where they all Voltron together and suddenly you have yourself a screenplay. And that wasn't until much later where I was up like an insomnia binge, and at 2 a.m, Discovery Channel had a thing on carnivorous plants. And Venus flytrap, also known as Dionea muscipala, I learned that they were not the feed me Seymour kind of look and face. After, and there was like 100 of them that come out of this one core, and they're identical. And the narrator was like, disguised as shelter for insects. And I went, what if we're the insects? What if there are 100 houses that look exactly alike all across the country and we don't realize that it's a Lovecraftian horror that is waiting for us inside.
It's an awesome idea.
And I'm like, I got it. And so I called up my manager. And I was like, good news. I've got an original horror story. I'm ready to pitch it. And he said two things. They're no longer buying original material. It has to be based on something else. And I'm leaving the business. So I was really screwed. And I decided, well, I mean, at the time I had gotten a job as a playtester for a video game company, which was the sexiest thing to all my friends, and it's the absolute most boring job. It's just hour upon hour sitting, especially sitting at the tool, and the tool that makes you feel you're the tool because you're testing a soak bug, so you can press pause on a game and you wait 5 hours and unpause it and see if it breaks. So during that time, I began writing the source material to my own original thing so that I could at least say, here's the source material on which it's based. Don't look at the name. Here's the source material. I have a script based on this. I was actually going to try a con that way. And so I built out an epistolary story, which was emails from a fictional friend of mine to me saying, hey, remember our mutual friend from back in the days when we did a bunch of board games together? I think he went into a restaurant in Idaho and shot two people after saying the door is open. What the fuck happened to our friend? And that led me down the story with this fictional friend, Mark, of there are houses and you go into them and either you don't come out, you run fleeing for your life, or you go in and you come out changed. And the people you hunt down and kill are the ones who fled for their life. So I was about 2/3 of the way through that story online when I discovered how Google Search Index works. And it doesn't care that you haven't promoted the site at all. It finds you somehow and does the nice little web crawl of the whole place and then makes you accessible. And so who knows who found me that night, but I can tell you I went to bed one night with 26 hits, which is just me checking links and putting up material. And the next night I had 4 million hits. I got slash dotted. I got, you know, put everywhere. And it was really intimidating. I had hundreds of email that came flooding in. About 20% understood it completely as fiction. They saw the copyright notice at the bottom. They bought all of that. And, you know, a good half of that 20% were like, you suck, your writing sucks, you didn't scare me at all. You know, that's the basic, you know, the basic way the internet communicates.
Well, you know, the fans have come so far now. That would never happen in 2016, so.
Right, right. The 80% was the one that fascinated me because it was gospel truth. I had people that said, hey, I went to school with Mark, or I live down the street from Jennifer. Give me the address. I want to go. I'll help you figure this out. And I didn't do anything on that for a while, but then it got worse. Jeff, let me tell you, I got a paranormal investigator. He has to take it up free of charge. He was like, I'm going to take this on. He gave me references. It was like, did you see the Lighthouse episode of Most Haunted? That was us. And then a minister in Louisiana said that he understood the evil I was facing and to contact him. I didn't do that scam. Because I fictionalized an article by the Idaho Statesman for, you know, the shooting of that my friend was responsible for, I had someone from that in Boise, a reporter, call me and say, hey, I did a LexisNexis search. I talked to all the coworkers. I can't find this. You're being frauded. Someone is scamming you. And I'm like, oh, honey, I don't know how to break this to you. And so at some point in time, I knew I had to wrap that up. I had already engineered the narrative so that I would get involved as a character, simply because that was a way that scared me more. And the house was aware that I knew about it. And so I introduced a character named Tracksuit Man, who, you know, fictional me found standing outside my apartment building at 2 a.m. And just staring. You know, it's like a carpenter, like Prince of Darkness. I don't know if anybody's seen that movie, but
great film.
It's that moment of just like, you know, it's like pray for death. You know, it's that it's that whole moment. I was in the middle of crafting that. I hadn't even published that page yet. And I'm way too late at the video game company. I'm driving home and there's a man in a tracksuit standing at the end of the street, and I go, oh my God. And I said, okay, this is, I got to stop the story right here. And so I cut it off suddenly, and used that as sort of a springboard to try and get some attention because it got viral. I was on Snopes accidentally. I didn't understand any of that ahead of time. I had to make it clear that because I was just telling a story that involved me, it didn't mean I was trying to perpetuate a hoax of some sort. And then that script sold, actually. That's the beauty about it. Agencies didn't pick it up right away. We went first to try and find an agent. And that was a weird bit because so many of those, like, I remember one agent, I was like, well, it's a Lovecraftian story, really. And they, Lovecraft, is that a couch? But then Warner Brothers bought it and preemptively, and suddenly I had a career. And the agencies were like, that guy, that Lovecraft guy, forget him. No, I should have talked to you. Can you sign? Come with this.
That's crazy. I mean, and that's great because you're making your own lightning, and that's what it's all about.
I think you have to.
That's what it's all about. So, you know, I know that you had a break for TV with like an official credit. Like one of your first producer writing credits was in 2006 for Stranger Adventures. You wrote an episode, if I'm correct.
Right. That wasn't a TV project, actually. That was new media. That was like a website series.
A web series. Okay. Yeah. But that was one of your first produced credits that I could find.
It
led to doing assignment work. And I just guess that I want to talk about for a second, a brief second. Don't worry, we're not going to traumatize you here.
You
did the adaptation for 2011's remake of The Thing.
I'm calling my therapist.
Yes, I mean, you might need to. But so basically, if you could give us a lesson going through your first like big studio project into somebody else's property, a beloved property.
Yeah.
What was the takeaway? What was the lesson that you learned from working on that as a writer, navigating studio territory and an IP that wasn't your original?
You know, I could say it starts and ends with passion, and both the director was already on board, Matthias was there when I came along, and needed someone to build the thing from the ground up with a handful of criteria, one of them being female lead, another being absolutely has to be a prequel that focuses on the Norwegian camp. This is the space. These are the lines to color in. And we went from there. And it was a fascinating project, and that is, I think it's the only script that I had to write by autopsy, being we used the forensic evidence of the 1982 film. And using all of that, we filled in as much as we could. And we wrote down every bit of information we had and said, let's find a way to organically work this into the story and then try our best to make some things that are surprising. There were so many things that were done, like the smartest version of them were already done in Carpenter's film. And so you had to find a way to have these characters, who are scientists, most of them, be as smart as possible, but also not step on the toes of the other very smart characters that we were already very familiar with, the iconic people from that film. And that seemed to be an impossible task. But that wasn't even the half of it. I mean, we got ourselves a film that I actually, as a writer, I was really proud of that script. We got it to a place where it was just, there were so many things that were like just love letters to, a good example, Lars. He was the cook. He was a Norwegian cook. He turned out to be a badass. He couldn't speak English at all. And the nickname that the other Norwegians had for him was Butterfingers. He would like drop the salt. He would like flip. You know, you'd think, oh, this guy is going to get killed right away. But no, it turns out he is an awesome, awesome dude. And he survives all the way to the end of our movie. We put him on the helicopter. And then you realize when you watch Carpenter's film, he's the guy who drops the grenade. So it's that kind of attention that we put into ours that it paid off in another movie. And so many moments that it's a mutt. And studios don't know what to do with mutts now. They have to fall into some exact category. Because we were doing a paranoia thriller and a sci-fi film and a horror film and sometimes a creature feature, it scared them. And the poor producers and the director had to fight crazy battles that interfered with the making of a quality film. Like, they stopped the set for a while, and I think they had an ongoing battle for about 3 weeks during production because some exec that was only on for about a month at Universal said, no, this movie has to be 3D. Shut everything down and bring 3D cameras in. That was just one of like 500 fights that went on constantly because of a scared studio that didn't know what it wanted to make.
It's tragic, but talking about something a little better, your writing directing debut in 2013, Hours.
Mm-hmm.
It was you know, great that you were able to use your all your earned credit to make your directorial debut on a feature film. And I'm curious, what was your biggest takeaway lesson from that?
Well, you know, I learned that directing is like the most brutally rewarding thing you can do. And I got asked way too many questions in a very condensed period of time. But that also helped me be a better writer and made me realize how important it is to do time and spend time working in a field adjacent to your own, making film or TV. And you can take away so much more that enriches all aspects of the business from that. More than anything, it was my attempt to prove to a business that wanted to keep me in one lane that I didn't have to be monogamous to genre and that I could do drama or I could do sci-fi or I could do anything else there. You know, Bill Lancaster, who wrote Carpenter's The Thing, he also wrote The Bad News Bears. I mean, we grew up with people that did all kinds of different films. And, you know, just because one of the 13 specs that I wrote that broke me in was horror and none of the others were, I don't want to do scary movies all the time.
Makes sense. And that, of course, brings us to our next question. And this is our last question before tonight's film. This is a great year for you. Over the summer, Lights Out came out. It was, great horror film for those who have seen it. It was adapted from David F. Sandberg's short film. And it was made, to my knowledge, for about $4.9 million. It did $67 million in the United States, helping for a cum of $148 million worldwide. It definitely found an audience. And this is just one of two films, Arrival being the second, that you had come out this year. What was your big lesson from Lights Out, which I quite enjoyed and I think came off kind of without a hitch? It seemed like the vision was preserved.
You know, it's missing a coda that apparently the test audiences were like, get this coda out of here, you know? So something went wrong there on this end. But I would say the thing I learned is how important it is to write things on spec if you're passionate about them. I wrote Arrival and Lights Out 5 years apart, and they both happened to come out in the same year. Lights Out was on sort of a very fast track to production because we had a very small window with our director, and we had an opportunity with James Wan's company that was just getting started, so there was a lot of sort of aligning of planets for that to happen. And Arrival was a long slog, you know. Arrival was the invisible war.
Let's get into it. So, I mean, I know 21 Laps, Sean Levy's company, the same company that made Stranger Things for Netflix this summer. To my knowledge, you initially had meetings with Dan Levine and executive producer Dan Cohen about, you know, Ted Chiang's 2002 collection of short stories, Stories of Your Life and others, specifically this story called Stories of Your Life. You know, when did you discover it? And were you the person that optioned the rights to it? And had held the rights to be able to pitch it, or had they already acquired the rights?
I had carried that book around with me for a number of years. When you do the bottled water tour and all the producers meet with you, they always ask you, is there a story that you want to adapt? And I would immediately, like, yes, absolutely, yes, finally, here we go. Story of Your Life, Ted Chiang. It's going to change your life. You got to read this. It's great. And they would ask me a little bit more. They're like, well, what's it about? Well, it's got a female lead. It's a non-franchise sci-fi. It's a real cerebral. It's about linguistic relativity. Immediately glassed over. Just like, what are you talking about? Like, it's not a scary movie. Like, no, it's not. Why does everybody think it's no? And it took me so long. It was like a good 2 years of answering that question with Story of Your Life and getting rejected and like, give me the water back. You know, there was plenty of those meetings that just went south, and I almost didn't say it. Like, I was on my way out the door, but they'd been very receptive to the script for hours and knew. There was a first conversation I had with producers where they didn't talk about horror. They just talked about like other movies and what did I want to do, blah, blah, blah. And they said, is there any material out there? And I went, well, you're not going to read it, but Ted Chiang. And they did. And they called back on Monday, like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. Like, I know, right? Oh my God. And we were off to the races. And they got a shopping agreement at that point in time. It's a very easy thing to grab. It's like a 90-day. We're going to go pitch this. Let us.
They got it from Ted.
From Ted. And we went around all the studios and did our pitch. I had my little visual note cards. I pitch with cards. And
stop. Tell us about that. How do you pitch with cards? Do you have images on them, or
it's all images. The only words are really character names because I found that execs, they hear so many pitches, and it's easy for them to forget what character is who in terms of what the names are. And so I put the name, and I Dreamcast it. And 2011, my card, I still have it on my cork wall. Amy Adams was for Louise. Like way back then, wow. I was like, this is the one. Like that's the one I got right.
So you show them images? Like are they photos?
They're photos
pasted onto index cards?
Or? They are. Like, well, I print them out. So I do a bunch of online stuff, and I use my old like graphic design stuff that I learned back in the NASA days, and I print that out directly. So they are stills that I think are evocative of what I'm pitching, or their specific pieces. It's kind of a mood board more than anything.
Were some of them symbols from
yes.
from the short story, which had a few symbols printed on the page inside of it?
I did some of that, and I did some of my own homegrown stuff. Like I did a little logogram of my own, and when I laid out the cards, I tend to find a spread. This is weird.
No, continue. Right. This is what I want to geek out on.
When I do a pitch presentation with visual cards, I tend to find a spread. Like I had one that dealt with a detective, a very logic, pragmatic detective who actually read the tarot as a way of trying to like find another way into things and just open up his perspective a bit. And so I would do a Celtic cross spread when I laid out the note cards for that. And here I made a circle. And so the last scene paired perfectly with the first scene, and we were right back at where we started. And all the studios were like, "That is really cool. We are never making this film."
It's funny because you were almost doing a paper version of what a lot of writers and directors started doing later than 2011, which is these fake trailers.
Right, reels. Yeah,
the sizzle reels where they're taking footage from other existing properties, not shooting anything on their own.
Rip-o-matic stuff.
To give the feel of what their movie's going to be with new, voiceover or music or no voiceover.
Yeah, I had no edit bay, those fancy spancy
right,
people.
Right. So you were ahead of the curve. Okay, well, so, I'd read that you had to actually pitch Ted on getting a short story so that he knew that its integrity would be intact. Do you remember what you told him before you went out?
Yes. Well, this was after we pitched it and everyone said no. I then got up the next day and I'm like, I got to write this. This is in my bones. I can't let go of this. So I want to write it on spec.
And everyone said no. How many meetings?
7.
Wow.
So basically like every major studio. And so my reps were like, no, that's ridiculous. They said, no, there's no buyer for this, Eric. Stop this. You're going to waste your time. And I'm like, I can't. I got to do this. And the producers were like, let's try this. Let's go. But this means we need to actually get right. Not a shopping agreement. We have to option the story proper. And they called me back like the next day. And they were like, well, Ted wants to hear it first. He's not giving it up. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, I'm pitching to Ted Chiang. Oh, God. Cause it's just really nerve wracking. It's like, so I'm going to take the keys to your car and I'm going to drive it around and I'm going to come back and there are gonna be some aftermarket things on it. And like, you're going to like, wait, that's not the right color. And, just trust me. So it was an hour long pitch over a conference phone. I couldn't even see him face to face. And I've done 100 pitches to like the worst. Oh, there's so many horror stories to studio execs, but I was the most nervous about this probably cause I idolized the man and I wanted to feel safe, but it was a very long, pregnant pause at the end of that. And he's like, all right, let's try this. Let's make this work. And I think one of the only reasons why he said that was we were the first to ever reach out to him to option something. He had one amateur writer who contacted him about some other story, and it just quickly faded. But we were the first one where we went to IMDb, and he's like, oh, these people actually work in the business. And now I think, red carpet, like everybody's knocking down, as they should, everyone's knocking down his door. And then he said, you have a year. And I started writing that night.
1 year. And was there an option to renew at the end of the year based on his predisposal of what he thought about
it? I am positive there was an option to renew. The producers said no, just because they wanted to put a gun to my head,
So they wanted you to be done and shopping it. Yeah. All within the course of the year. So when you sit down to adapt something like this, it's about 39 pages.
Yeah.
Did you break it into an outline? Talk about your process of adaptation for a second.
I had done a lot of heavy lifting to craft the pitch. And so the story was broken out on a certain level. And I went back and I put all of those images on the one half of my board. When I do some story architecture, I have my left brain, right brain, where I have the very basic spinal column questions of like, how, what are the choices the character makes that drives the story to the next thing? How am I going to make this work? And then the other side is just the complete like attention deficit disorder space where if I have little ideas of dialogue, I'll put them up there. Or if I see a jacket someone's wearing in a magazine ad, I tear it apart. And I'm like, yeah, Ian, where's this? And, you know, sometimes it's just a landscape shot or something cool on the web that I find, and I'll print out a piece of it.
I'm sorry, this is the geekiest thing, but you kept the name of Louise from the short story?
Yes.
But you changed Ian's name because he had a different name in the short story. I was always curious why.
Because I have a bad personal reaction to Gary. Gary just is not, I don't,
you didn't like the way it sounded?
Gary, I don't like Gary.
All right.
It's a personal baggage thing, but I had to change it.
All right, I had to know because it's just so random. We will talk spoilers later for sure, but you know, I just want to know, let's talk about your habit for a second because you're already in it. When you sit down to write, do you give yourself an hourly, I'm going to write for this long, or do you give yourself a page count each day?
I do it hourly. And that comes from the days that I worked in Houston, the days that I was like a cubicle monkey for some soulless corporation. I had to do that for 8 or 9 hours, and it just gave me that window of discipline of like, this is my work time.
So is that what it is, 8 or 9 hours for writing?
Yeah.
Okay. 5 days a week, or do you go on the weekend?
5 days a week. Well, okay. It's bled over now where when I take meetings or I have other events that really show up in the middle of the day that interfere with my writing time, I feel a little bit cheated, or I feel like I'm cheating my own schedule. So it spills into the weekend of like, I got to make up those 2 hours that I had to drive over to so-and-so's.
That makes sense. What do you do if you get writer's block? If you get it, how do you battle it?
I have a lot of little Eric life hacks that I use to try and break it. And I try any number of them. Sometimes none of them work, but it's important for me to go through all of them. You know, the first, it depends on who shows up. You know, if I have the judge that shows up and says, well, that's crap, you got to stop right there until you get me non-crap. And I can lock up just trying to be the perfectionist on the page. Then I do I want to write the absolute most cartoonishly bad version of the scene. I want to write the worst version possible. And that frees up the judge. And honestly, it's a paper tiger for me. Writer's block is always it's so big and scary, and then after 5 minutes of writing, it's like, poof. And so I have to find a way to get writing for 5 minutes solid, and then that goes away. The demons back off.
So how long did it take you to get your first draft for Stories of Your Life, like which became a writer?
Story of Your Life, the first draft was about 3 months. It was a 3-month-long process that I brought into the Dans.
How long was it?
It was around 120. It was like 118.
And what year was that?
That was middle of 2011, somewhere around there.
Okay.
And, the spring. It was the spring of 2011. And I brought into the Dans, and it needed work, you know, and they were super helpful and nurturing. The lovely thing about Dan Cohen and Dan Levine is, and I don't know how they continue to work in this business, because they were like, man, you got a lot of like stuff in here. It sounds like the studio execs talking to you as you write this. You don't need all this stuff, man. You know, just tell the story. Tell the story as smart as you want it to be. And I was like, all right.
It's rare.
But a handful of times they would call me on something and I'd get all like, you know, I'd get all defensive. A good example of that is the first draft, the very first draft, I had a whole series of scenes that were little scenelets, really, of Louise teaching very basic vocabulary to the heptapods. And Ian would demonstrate. And it was just super like kindergarten level words. And they were like, Eric, this is not sexy at all. This is really boring. This is really, I don't want to, you're not, no actor is going to want to try and do it. What are you doing here? What are you doing? And I said, I don't know how to get around. Like, this is what they got to learn. Like, no, why do they have to learn this? And I'm like, fine. And I went to their whiteboard and I wrote, this is the question we're trying to get to. And here's how difficult it is. And here's how many sessions you have. And after all of that, then you have to have enough vocabulary with them so that they can answer the question. And you can't even go specific, you know, because I said, what's a Pulaski? And they're like, we don't know. And I'm like, well, it's a tool that firefighters use. You can't start with Pulaski. You got to start with tool. And they just stared at me for a while and they're like, that's the scene that goes in the movie. Get rid of this other crap. That's the scene. And they were right.
That's possibly one of the better examples of executive notes that I've heard having a good result. So that's
exactly
that is fantastic.
They're smart people.
Well, so what happened when your year ended? Did you
had a script that we were really excited about? Like we had a nice, fresh, shiny spec, and we went back out to all those same studios that passed on the pitch, and they said this is an amazing script, and they passed on the script. But this time, independent financiers were suddenly a contender. And it was like the featherweight competition. It was like, you know, we'll offer you $20. We'll offer you $20 on a pizza. But they were like really passionate about it. And they were scrappy. And a number of these smaller groups came in and were fighting over it in a way that none of the studios were. And during that bidding war, Lava Bear and Film Nation discovered that they were both in the same Hunger Games over this. And they Voltron together. And they defeated everybody that way. And they were like, hey, we'll make this together. Screw all these other guys. And that's why you see those two names at the top of the film. They actually are the ones that got it made. Paramount and Sony acquired it at Cannes after we had Denis and Amy, which is really the time at which it's that's when it's worthwhile of a risk for a studio. Like without those people, they're just looking at, again, female lead, non-franchise.
Well, right. And Denis' directing was amazing, and Amy obviously could vouch on her own. Are you able to say what the budget was when it was acquired?
It was mid-40s.
Okay. And what became the schedule for the film, ultimately?
I don't know what is the final schedule for that. I think we had a little over... We had around 45 days of shooting as well. We scraped by. We made it work, a handful of scenes that we had to combine or condense during that. But there was a lot of material that was actually shot that ultimately didn't make it. You know, the third version of a movie is always found in editing.
So we're going to get to the spoilers section now.
Oh, boy.
There is so much to discuss. So podcast listeners, if you have not seen this film, this is the time to press pause and go see it. Look, the beauty of your script and this film ultimately becomes like the revision of exposition and whittling down to the simplest things to win the scenes. Because I've read the short story. I've read your 2012 draft, which we're going to talk about a little as well. And there's just interesting changes. I want to start with a short story for a second. You know, the daughter dies, Hannah dies when she's 25.
Right.
And it was a rock climbing accident.
Right.
And she was a financial consultant of sorts. And, you know, there was some, the mom couldn't tell if, you know, she was living her life the way that she wanted to.
Right.
What gave you the idea to make it the loss of a younger child due to a degenerative illness?
Part of it was we needed to make sure the child didn't get old enough that we'd have to age up the actress playing Louise. Because that gave away
much. Sure, that gave away the time.
That gave away everything. Because, and we didn't want to spoil that. And the other was a bit more complicated. It deals with the fact that the message in Ted's story there was more about Louise embracing the inevitable. It was a very kind of deterministic realization of that likely everything is predestined and you just got to find a way to make peace with that. And I was a bit rebellious about that. I'm like, Ted, I don't like that. I don't like that at all. And I said, I think it's more profound for me if she has a choice, if she has free will and can change her future, and yet she chooses to have Hannah. That to me is more affecting. That gets me, and that's really where I wanted to land on it. But if I did that, then I had to make sure it wasn't a rock climbing accident in which Louise could just call the day before and say, "Hey, don't go."
Obviously, you're getting into the biggest reveal of the film, which is that these are not flashbacks, but furthermore, flash forwards.
Right.
That she's experiencing in time, seeing the future, and opting to go for the love of her child. Even though she knows the child's going to die.
Right.
There was something in the short story that really kind of struck me, and it was this whole conversation of the Book of Ages.
Yes.
And predestination, as you were saying.
Right.
And I'm just curious if you kind of want to get into that a little more, because it was kind of the way the Hepapods live their lives, and even Abbott and Costello, mm-hmm. you know, knew that he would die in that scene.
Right.
Which in the short story from those two army guys was actually just like kind of a big shootout, not an explosion. Another thing that I think you improved on really well. So I'm kind of curious about that. Actually, no, sorry. That was in your script. That was not in the short story. Because in the short story,
right,
they were not on Earth.
No, not at all.
Sorry, I'm going to go to Book of Ages in a second. In the short story, there was 118 rooms set up across the world, which you whittled down to 12 spaceships.
Right.
And in these rooms in the short story, the aliens were not present.
No.
They were on television sets, for lack of a better way to say it.
Right.
And I'm actually curious to start there for a second before we get to the predestination. What gave you the idea to put them in the same room?
Well, it came out of a need for conflict and tension, really. Ted's story is elegant and evocative and very literary and has no drama there on that level. It just, there's no, you're like, wow, it's great. And then you transfer and you're like, oh, I'm so screwed. There is no film here. Like, what is, no one's going to, I can't have him spend a year in a room Skyping with some aliens. This is not a film. And the first major change that I pitched to him and that we brought to it was they show up at our door. And there's more than one of them, but there's not 118. And we have to figure out why they're here. And instantly that gave me a kind of a strange ticking clock. And that ticking clock is the public's need for an answer.
And the threat of the unknown, which is what sends people into a panic.
Always.
You know, just talking about the heptapods for a second. In the short story, they had radial symmetry with their eyes, in which there were eyes all around their head, which I thought was very interesting because it gives them the inability to understand the concept of forward, which is a way that they look at time, because any way they go is forward.
Yeah.
What actually kind of made the movie change that to an extent? Like, because you never get deep enough, so maybe the eyes are there and I can't see them. But I thought that was a really interesting detail of the short story that wasn't made clear in the movie.
I love that detail as well. I mean, what Ted did so well in that was he custom built creatures that felt like they would be naturally attuned to a nonlinear existence, you know, and nonlinear language. And I, you know, for the longest time in this script, they were basically that description in that. And then we got to the place where VFX was like, can you show us something that this looks like? And we're like, oh, not at all. Not at all, in fact. And Denis was fascinated with all the brand new deep sea life that we were just discovering in the past 5 years. And we started seeing some things that looked interesting to him and gravitated toward more of like a squid-like thing. And what I liked about that, of course, was the old Lovecraft brain kind of kicked in, and I'm like, I am terrified of this, and I shouldn't be because they are actually being nice to us, but my lizard brain doesn't know that.
In your 2012 draft, they had necks that could turn all the way around 360 degrees, so you preserved a little of that, but you also had them wearing one piece of clothing. Something on their
shoulder.
They're
wearing clothing?
Well, not clothing that was full, but there was something that there was not part of their body that you kind of described on their shoulder. And I was just curious where you wanted to go with that, if you even remember. Or was that just a detail that you kind of threw in?
That was a detail that I probably threw in to appease some producer who was like, are they identical? What's different about them? And
sure.
I'm like, there's a thing. All right, there you go.
On their shoulder, yeah.
Yes.
All right. They were in the short story called Flapper and Raspberry.
Right.
How did you arrive at Abbott and Costello?
I've always been a fan of the classic miscommunication skit, Who's On First? And I thought, what better way to talk about miscommunication than to name them that?
How long would you say the time is of the movie? It seems like it's about maybe a month
about
and a
half. Month.
Okay.
A little over a month.
Did you ever play with it being longer or shorter than that or any other ideas for time?
Certainly. We accordioned out for about like a 3 month period and we moved back to like, do we do this in 2 weeks? And we tried a few other of those options. There was a lot of R&D that went into this, just trying to figure out the right notch on the dial.
There was no zero gravity entry in the 2012 draft.
That's all Denis.
And it was beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about collaborating with Denis for a second. Just the concept of just this almost Escher puzzle of jumping up and landing sideways and then looking behind you and it's down.
Yeah, it's trippy. I think he just had a lot of ideas, and more than anything, he's a lover of procedural. Like, he loves to just sort of slow things down and think about how people would realistically tackle something like that. And he wanted to make the first experience into the shell as otherworldly as possible. And whereas I had them just entering a tunnel of sorts, but it was all still on our gravity, he wanted something that felt very otherworldly, really, very alien.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check www.backstory.net for updates. I know you've heard me say this before, but backstory.net really is going to go live this year, and I've even seen some proof of concept, and we have a lot of back-end stuff to figure out, so thanks for bearing with me. I cannot wait for you to see this. But if you have an iPad, you could check out issue 20, which we published today. You could check it out right now. It has our Snowden cover story. We have over 12,000 words for an in-depth look at what it took to make Snowden, from three separate cover story articles on the film, which include co-writer Kieran Fitzgerald, actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and co-writer director Oliver Stone. So you're going to love diving into our in-depth coverage of Snowden. In issue 23, we also interviewed iconic comic book writer Garth Ennis about creating his Preacher comic series. There's a TV piece with the co-writer of our new favorite show, Vice Principals. We interviewed the creators of an artificial intelligence computer program named Benjamin, and that AI program became a screenwriter to write a short film called Sunspring, and they gave us all the details about what it took to teach a computer to write a script. You can also read Zoe McCarthy's entire Blacklist script, Cut and Run, plus an interview with her all about it. And you could also read Billy Domeneu's utterly insane Seinfeld spec TV script, a what if they did a 9/11 episode called Twin Towers. It's a spec, obviously it was never made, but you could read that in crazy spec and an interview with Billy. And we've also got magician Derek Delgadio, who takes us behind his immersive one-man narrative-driven show at the Geffen. Plus, we've got plenty of current cinema as well, including Andrew Stanton on Finding Dory, Paul Feig and Katie Dippold on Ghostbusters, Taylor Sheridan on Hell or High Water, James Seamus on Indignation, plus the writers of Sausage Party, Star Trek Beyond, War Dogs, and more. So folks, don't miss this issue. I know you're going to dig it, and I can't wait to hear your feedback. Remember, if you have an iPad, the app and issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. Look, I really appreciate all your help in spreading the word about and supporting my passion project. But now, let's jump right back into this podcast, sponsored by the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship. So don't forget to get your script into ScreenCraft.org before their January 2017 deadline. And now we're going to jump right back onto the stage of my sold-out screening with screenwriter Eric Heiserer to discuss his passion project, Arrival.
You've directed yourself, as we've talked about. You've worked with a lot of great directors. What were some of the creative habits that you noticed of Denny that kind of maybe influenced you after working together with him so closely on this project?
You know what he was really good at? He was really good at like asking all sorts of questions about subtext. Like, so often a director will come on board, they'll have read the script themselves, but they don't have a conversation with the writer so much as like, hey, good job now. And then you put your kid in their car and they drive off and you're just like, and how they interpret your material is kind of out of your hands at that point. And sometimes they have a great movie at the end of it that misses some of the things that you put, but has new interpretations or takes it in another direction that's equally good. It just wasn't what you were saying. And with Denis, what I was fascinated by with him was he grilled me on every page. He grilled me, what's the subtext here in this, you know, and what's this line of dialogue, and why did you use this verbiage in the narrative? And like he just combed through that to try and glean as much information as possible. And, you know, having lived with it for so many years, I had a bunch of answers. Like, I could answer a bunch of it, and anything that I couldn't, we're like, I don't know what that is. And he's like, oh, don't, you know, that's it.
Well, so was there anything that was kind of a forest for the trees moment where a third party was coming in and kind of made you see something differently about your script that you hadn't previously realized?
I'm sure everybody, starting with Denis, was like that. Everybody got it, and everybody wanted to make the same movie, and they all knew how to make it better. There was always something like, oh, I see what you're doing, kid. Good job. Now take the expert here, and we're going to go off with it. So that was really amazing to see. It was a real unicorn of an experience for me.
In the short story, you know, the way that they communicated the heptapods, they used computers, and they had lights on kind of the end of their tentacles. It was described as what came out was inky spider silk. Where did the idea of dark ink, kind of like out of an octopus almost floating in the air, come about? Because that also was not in your 2012 draft.
Right. Now, that also came from working with the creature design team, like after we'd started to settle on a more of a cephalopod look, you know, with the creatures, with the heptapods.
There was a moment in your 2012 draft, just kind of, I want to show the evolution, where they were basically speaking English. And they had a computer device that was sending back English words to the team. And I was curious if...
Oh, they're still speaking their language, but then they had a translator for English.
Yeah. So she could read what they were saying in English, which right. This movie, really cool, it doesn't do that, in which we see her really learning their language. And I'm just curious if that was the result of a crazy note or something like that, maybe to make it clearer to the audience, something that you just couldn't tell on the page how it was going to work out on the screen.
I got rid of that before Denis came on because I was just not satisfied with that version. And it led me to a draft where only Louise could understand them, but nobody else, including the audience, could keep up. And she was starting to identify words that nobody had seen yet. And I found that more dramatically interesting. So I was still working on it before anybody really did anything with it. You know, like I would go and do something to keep the lights on at my apartment. And then I'd come back to this script time and again, even while we were pining away for Denis to get time to look at it or anybody at that point. And I thought, you know, this isn't the best version of this scene. There's a better way into that. And that's what got the scene later on where Louise signs her name in a circle.
Which was a great moment because she's helped by a heptapod.
Because the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is in full effect then, and she's starting just to think more and more like them.
And that leads to one of her dreams, because they're asking if she dreams. Were there other dreams that you played with aside from the heptapod just kind of being in the corner?
That actually was something that came out of an editorial process, because we didn't have that originally as a dream. We had that as an intervention moment where Weber is also in the room there, and it was actually shot that way. There was a scene where we actually saw Amy Adams' signature of Louise Banks in the circle, and they're saying, Weber's line was, "You got to understand why we have to take you off of this project now. It's one thing when no one can understand them. It's another when no one can understand them but you."
It's a fascinating moment. I mean, what I think is brilliant about your process is that you were so in love with the story that you never gave up on it. And you allowed yourself to keep revising, though, because some people wouldn't. And I utterly love this film.
Finished with this now.
No, yeah, you're going to keep working on it. The film is brilliant. The script is brilliant. But, you know, there was a 2012, I'm just going back to that draft again. Yeah. I'm almost done with it.
Oh, boy.
There was a trope where there was just more information in there.
Yeah.
And so the information that the heptapods were giving, disseminating in 12 parts in that version, was actually the engineering designs for how to build an ark, as you called it, a spacecraft.
Yeah.
And each of the nations had pieces of it that they would need to bring together to share to travel. And one of the nations had the map of a place to go that they could colonize that would be good for Earthlings, us folks.
Yeah.
And it's a totally acceptable sci-fi trope.
Sure.
But it's a mission, which is what your film Arrival ultimately used, makes it more mysterious and more intriguing. So what was it like to give up something so conventional and understandable? And by the way, cool. It is a cool concept to give 12 pieces to an ark for the humanity needs to come together to build it so that we could go on and be fruitful and multiply in the galaxy. How did that end up out of there?
Well, I'll first say where it started. And it started with me seeing a science program where someone was very convincing, telling me that if humanity doesn't colonize at least one world, we may be looking at the sunset of our time as a race. And the moment we colonize just one other world, our life projections as the human race, all humanity, suddenly goes into like billions more years, like maybe even trillions more. Like it goes crazy we're suddenly at the very beginning of our timeline. And that's something that I played with for a long time in the script. And that some of the graphics that were put in there was all about that timeline.
Actually, to focus on that for a second, they got an image from the heptapods that they thought meant mankind was at the end of their time.
Right.
And you showed them talking on the other side of a piece of glass it was drawn on later when they're analyzing it, realizing with their nonlinear style that it might mean that what they're giving them puts humanity at the beginning of their timeline.
That's right.
So that was a really good trope, too.
And that was the designs of the ship. And then Interstellar came out. And the producers called me and said, Denise worried because Interstellar. And I'm like, I know, I saw it. And he says, well, we love the ship. Can you go talk to him and calm him down? And I sat down with Denise and I say, I think we need to change it. He's like, oh, good. Excellent. We will change this now. I don't like it. Why don't you like it? And I said, I'll tell you why. Because I've been seeing more and more how we really, can I say this, how we fucked up this planet a lot.
Yeah.
And there's something bad about here. Have another planet go fuck up. Here, just like travel to this place. And I don't want to have that message. I don't want to have the message of like, why don't you pollute another world for us? And he's like, all right, yes. All right, let's try something else. And we arrived at the idea that the language itself can be a gift just because of how it really expands your perspective about your life and time and
the language was technically the weapon per se.
It was. Yeah. So that's kind of where we went. And because we went that way, we got to pull back on a lot of exposition. We got to pull back on a lot of things that otherwise would have been tropes.
It's a major refinement. So, you know, when General Shang is going into attack mode,
right.
And that's kind of your crisis point that everything's boiling up to.
Sure.
You know, no
from
one is
our POV
from our POV.
Right.
What would have happened in your mind if he did launch an attack? Would it have messed up the aliens, or would the heptapods just have left without really delivering us the information that we needed to survive, and that would have just been the end of our relationship?
They need this to work, and they know what they have to sacrifice in order to make it work. They know that already. They know the losses going into this fight, but they also know that it's crucial that we learn this so that in 3,000 years we save their ass somehow. In fact, the line that was in the script for the longest time when she talks to Costello and she asks that question, why are you here? He says, we're here to return the favor.
Which is a great line. I want to talk about protecting the flash forward concept.
Sure.
Because it's a big moment in the third act when we realize that these are not flashbacks of her daughter dying, but they're flash forwards. And then they're interspersed with the story that we're watching, which we thought was present tense,
right,
but technically is the past. What were some of the things, other than worrying about Amy's makeup for aging, that you needed to do in your screenplay to protect that secret? Things that put it at risk.
Sure. First, though, trivia. One studio exec, you know, if you get rid of all the flashbacks, we'll make the movie.
Really? Please tell me what studio. I mean, did you play with that idea? Did you say,
no.
Really, could you tell me how we could get rid of the flashbacks of this movie?
No, I didn't even. I was like, all right, thank you.
That's like Usual Suspects. If you could get rid of this Kaiser Soze guy.
Yeah, get rid of Kaiser Soze.
We don't ever see him, really.
You really don't. You don't pay it off. Like, I don't, what? So.
Wow, that's crazy. That's a crazy piece of trivia.
So the short story is so evenly divided into chapters, little chapterettes, actually, of just a moment where it's the team at the site, and it's the, you know, the translation with the heptapods, and then it's done in second person, you know, addressing you directly as the daughter in the other scenes. And so there's just a little bites of each, and you go back and forth between that. I discovered early on in the drafting of this that I couldn't get away with that in the telling of the feature. I needed to stick a little more closely to how the effect of the language would alter her POV and would basically trigger these fugues states of the moments when she would have a scene with her daughter. And that couldn't start really until she started to see the written language. And that was like a good way into the second act. And then it's had to expand kind of on a logarithmic scale and get more and more intense. And other stuff I learned about that, when they happened at first, she was unaware when she was in the other timeline that she had jumped. And it wasn't until she came out of that she got affected by it. and back into the present day. But when they began happening with a greater frequency, it started really mess with her. She was getting sort of like a time jump whiplash of sorts. And there's a scene in which she has to ask her daughter, what day is it? Because she's having to catch up with where she is. And that's how, when it gets so intense and it goes back and forth when she's talking to General Shang, she can't even remember what she's already done. Because she's caught up. And the general has to help her a little bit.
And it's kind of downloading to her through, like, over the course of time.
Yeah.
Kind of like the circle that they communicate in.
And the fact that she can change it, and she realizes she can change it when she hops back to tell non-zero-sum game. Like, that's the game changer, really.
Right. The non-zero-sum game was a great moment where her daughter prompts her with that, and she realizes that is what's taking place, technically.
Yeah.
You know, there was a trope that I thought, I'm just putting this out there on my own. I don't know if this was an influence for you, but the first time I saw the movie, I was thinking a lot about Solaris.
All
because
right.
That's a film that deals with loss, deals with the timelessness and
yeah.
jumped out of time, the haunting of the loss. Was that an influence for you at all? Because with all the water and staring into the lake, man, did I think of Solaris a lot. And I say that as a compliment because I love right. Solaris, both versions.
I appreciate it. I had always had more of a love affair with Close Encounters, but I totally see where you're coming from with Solaris. I think Denis certainly had that as an inspiration, as well as 2001.
Yeah, absolutely, 2001. There was a really fascinating moment that I want to talk about from the 2012 draft that was also lost, again, to the benefit of the movie.
Right.
But it was fascinating in which after Abbott dies
uh-huh.
from the explosion,
right.
which, you know, was an element that was in the short story, and that, you know, you made it an explosion here, which was just great. The paranoia of these army men scared what to do. They're going to screw everything up. She's taken in to the ship, just like kind of in your movie. But in that meeting, she sees Abbott in like a coffin of sorts or laying there dead. And on the walls in a circle is written their whole history.
Right.
And they get into talking about it. And I mean, I love the scene.
Yeah.
But again, it's a mission is the correct thing to do, but it's about how the heptapods are saying that her choice to have her daughter, even though she knew that there was going to be a terminal illness,
right.
inspired Abbott to face death and break from this pattern that we were talking about before with the Book of Ages.
Right.
And it inspired the heptapods to be free in time.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious kind of to tell us more about that and the decisions that you played with of whether or not she would ever find something outside of her loop to not have the child. Because it's interesting how, again, it's exposition. They relate
yeah.
how she inspires them.
Right.
And that's why they're technically giving her the most of their language to then disseminate through her book. So
right.
tell us about that scene, what it meant to you, and then its exclusion.
You know, I think that was more exposition than we needed for the film. The script, especially in 2012, which feels like a decade ago to me right now, because that's like 100 drafts ago. That's like, you know, it's like a long while. You know, that had so many answers baked into it, but all of those answers, of course, spawned at least two questions. That the gift of having Denis on board was his way of treating the script as kind of like a Jenga game and pulling out pieces until something didn't make sense. And he realized very early on that less is a lot more when it came to how much information we got from the heptapods. And so we lost the library that you talked about that had the entire history written in their language, and we lost a few other things simply because it was more information, and the more mysterious they remained, the more excited Denis got. In fact, there was a moment where Denis was like, "Eric, we must have something that even we don't know the answer to." That's how alien these are. I'm like, "All right, Denis, what are you gonna do here?" It's like, "These 12 locations, we must not know why they're the..." Okay, all right. Let's talk about what they could be. Like, okay, what could they be? No, let's not talk. Okay.
I love the dialogue saying that Sheena Easton had a hit
in
each of
exactly.
the locations.
Yeah, throwing stuff at the wall
yeah,
at that
in
point.
The 1980s. You know, it's interesting because the concept of still going through with it it's something that's not even totally sci-fi, because with just genetic awareness these days, pregnant women are able to see if spina bifida is a possibility.
Totally.
And, you know, that's a disease that they could avoid. Was that something that kind of inspired that for her and her reason to keep the daughter?
There's a line that was so important to me with her, and it was when she was talking about why Hannah's dad left, and was talking about the unstoppable disease, and she said, kind of like you with your poetry and your swim trophies. And what she's talking about is her daughter's contributions to the greater world and how she affects many other people, possibly even inspires other people, and how if you remove Hannah even from the short time that she's there on the planet, how many other people is she affecting, possibly even negatively? And the thought about even if she knows that there's a heartache, a horrible heartache at the end of this journey with her daughter, and she's going to lose her after that time, the fact that she manages to touch other people during the years that she's on this planet, and what that effect has on everybody else, and what a possibly even her loss has on her friends and the family of her friends, that there's far greater consequences to that. So there's some selflessness involved in her going through with her choice, and there's also just the fact that she would rather have loved and lost than to never have Hannah at all.
Right. Was there ever a scripted scene of the breakup between Ian and her, or her telling Ian the truth about Hannah?
There was like a phone call, so it was one side, but it was it was a scene that like later on we didn't have. Oh my God. Oh, but there was a scene that we shot that this kills me, but I understand completely why I had to get rid of it. It was an expansion of the scene in which 12-year-old Hannah says to the camera, "I hate you," you know, that moment early on in that little collection of scenes. And it was 12-year-old Hannah and Louise, and Louise is grounding her for not doing her homework and trying to get out and going and see her friends. And Hannah says a line that like every kid says at some point in time, and just right at mom, is like, "Why won't you just let me live my life?" And Amy Adams has the most profound, just the look on her face. I'm like, I'm going to tear up just thinking about like how crazy of like how that affected her. And she just says in the softest voice, "I will." And that happened in the middle of our movie. And the second time any of us saw it, it just broke the movie. We're like, we can't come back from that. That just wrecks us. Like that just, how can you go?
Sweet, why not move it to the end? Because there was a modular level of how those flash forwards could be used. And
yeah.
Just I want to say this for the record. I've read your script. You have the breaks in time in your script.
Yeah.
The editing in this film is fantastic, but you really also had it on the page.
Sure.
Did you ever consider moving it forward?
Well, I'm sure that there was a lot of thought to that, but I also know that we had a lot of other things that are happening in the end. And to go one more to that ending reveal, you didn't want to feel too much like, now here are my cards. You know, we weren't trying to do a magic trick. And there are several places in the movie that audiences can understand what is going on, that they're not actually seeing the past, you know, especially when she just asks, who is this child? But yeah, you know, certainly we wanted to save that for somewhere, but it just didn't work.
The moments with General Chang were incredible, when she is literally getting his phone number, hearing what he said to his wife as she died.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what inspired that, because that was an invention of yours that was not in the short story.
It's
and
true.
And I really want to hear about what brought you to that stage, because it's great.
That scene itself was crafted as a way, it was a little tropey to Doctor Who fans, but I mean, other than that, it was, you know, it was a way to find a climax that still hinged on Louise's choices and her actions, but did not involve, you know, a human punching an alien in the face or anything like that.
Or any shooting. You know, aside from human-on-human violence, there's actually nothing else.
That was it. Like, you know,
which is a triumph, by the way.
R.I.P. Abbott. But other than that, and so that came out of it. But let me tell you the little story about that scene with General Chang, and I'm not going to forgive him for a long time. Many, many drafts, it said, you know, Louise says something in Mandarin to the general. And we were about 3 months away from shooting. And Denise calls me, Eric, what does she say? I'm like, I don't know. She says something in Mandarin. I have the woman here who translates from Mandarin. She's going to teach Amy Adams what to say. What does she say? I'm like, you have to teach. Oh, right, because she's actually saying, oh God. And she's like, Eric, this is the line that saves the world. This is the most important line in the whole movie. Eric, what have you done to me? You must find this for me right now. And I'm like, oh God, I started sweating. I just come up with like draft after draft after draft, all manner of lines of dialogue for this. And I bring it to him. And you got to understand the way Nadine works. He says two things at the same time. He's like, Eric, you are a wonderful human being. You're a fantastic writer. This is terrible. Like, just at the same time, it's like, this is an utter embarrassment. I'm ashamed. And then, you know, and you go back to the board, and you're like, and you find, and you get maybe to like, okay. When you get to that okay mode, and you're like, all right, that's good, but it's not what you want to hear from him. And when you hear it, then you're addicted to it, and that's all you want to hear. And when he finally says, I deeply love this. You're like, yes, score. I finally got there. And I did that for the better part of a month and went through a bunch of lines.
What was your worst General Shang idea?
The worst one?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Not his wife's dying words.
It was always what his wife's dying words were. And it was always like, what was it she said to him? And it was just tropey stuff.
There's no translation. Cliche. So unless we speak Mandarin.
Unless you speak Mandarin. But
turn on the subtitles on the DVD.
That's the thing. I worked so hard on it, and I finally got the line. He was so happy with it. And I was there in Toronto seeing the final cut, and I'm like, that bastard, he'd put no subtitles on this. He made me work so damn hard for this line. And nobody, unless you speak Mandarin, can... Oh.
Well, so tell us, what was it?
This is the one he deeply loved. In war, there are no winners, only widows.
Nice. I can see that stopping General Shang. Taking a minute. What was your function on set? Were there any rewrites to do? Were you there during production?
I was there. I was there for a couple of weeks. There was an overlap with lights out, so I couldn't stay as long as I wanted to. But it was a well-oiled machine. I mean...
Were there any big rewrites or something that you needed to do as a writer, or something to retool from rehearsals or shooting?
It was just the extra writing of what is this anchor person saying in the background on this report.
So just little things, okay.
Little things. Or we would be hour seven into a scene that was almost all Louise dialogue, and there was poor Jeremy Renner in the full hazmat suit, like going, what am I doing all day? What's going on here? And like, you know, the producers are like, I'll go. And we'll give dialogue to some other people that are like spending their hard earned hours there in very uncomfortable suits.
Well, I mean, it's indicative of the short story in which it is Louise's story.
Yeah.
And Ian, you know, is there as a bystander, and to your credit, this movie never became a cheesy space love story. That's all basically off screen, which is a huge triumph, actually.
Yes.
And I am curious if there was ever a note like, guys, we have Jeremy Renner. Do we want to give him something else to do than puke in the wastebasket after he takes off his hazmat suit?
We had more for him. We had a lot. We had Jeremy Renner explaining Bayes' theorem applied to global population with a salt shaker in a cafeteria. Like, we had him demonstrating Fermat's principle of least time. We had all sorts of great sciencey stuff. And Jeremy is a smart man. He's like intimidatingly smart. And I'm like, I don't know if I can. Oh, God. Okay, here we go. And they were all great scenes. But again, this is Louise's story. And you want to make it as aerodynamic as possible. And we had to winnow those out. There was even a few like Colonel Weber scenes that were like really seminal in identifying who he was as a character and the fights that he was having that never ended up making it to the final cut.
Anything you want to tell us about the editing process, the last stage of storytelling, and then we're going to get a question or two from the crowd?
It just removing the pieces that, you know, were great but just weren't absolutely integral to the story. And it was that... making it, like I said, as aerodynamic as possible.
Last question before we turn it over to the crowd for a few. What was your toughest scene? What was the scene that you kept coming back to again and again, and how did you creatively get through that scene? What was the breaking point for you where you were able to break through?
The scene for the longest time was how Louise solved it all, you know, and her way of sharing that with everybody else. For so long, even back in the 2012 draft and for a year after that, it was her trying to explain to a room full of talking heads or you know, reach out to the 12 sites and talk to the science teams there, or even just Weber and Jim Halpern, or David Halpern, Stuhlbarg's heritage,
the CIA guy.
The CIA guy, to have them in the room and convince them of it. And it never really worked the way I wanted it to. And the big reveal with General Shang for me isn't that he was integral in turning the tide from war to, you know, to compromise and cooperation. It was that our perception on the American side of what the Chinese were doing was very warmongery and was very sort of, you know, tropey Chinese. In reality, he's an esteemed gentleman and he's a really smart man. And how much of that was filtered through the U.S. intelligence framework, and how much of that was like us projecting onto who we think China is right now versus who they really are? Same thing with Russia. Same, all the foreign countries and how we perceive them. How much of that information got mutated? Because at the end of the day, this is about communication, and it's about how we have to be more honest and transparent with one another.
Right.
And not jump to conclusions. And
that's what saves the world, in which General Shang, he immediately broadcast the data that they got rather than the United States doing it first.
Yeah.
And that was the olive branch offered to the world that everybody else grasped on, and that ends the movie, which is great.
Right.
We're going to take a few questions from the crowd. I'm going to go right there, you, sir, in the middle, in the hoodie. How did you get Amy and Denis attached to a script that no studio wanted to make? Great question.
Denis is one of those rare breeds who looks at the blacklist and sees the great unproduced scripts out there, because he doesn't attach himself to a script that needs a lot of work. I don't think he has the emotional capacity or interest to do that kind of thing. I think he looks for something that's really good and most of the way there, and then he just makes it so much better.
Another question right behind the guy that we just had a question from. He was curious about the process of revision, which is what's so great about your script. And what were some of the points in which, with Denis, that you decided you didn't need something? Like, for instance, the diagram of humanity either at the beginning of the line or the end of the line, because these are great things from the script that really popped off the page.
I can say Denis shot so much of that. He shot like 90% of that, and he had that material. And going into editorial, the big question was, what could he pull out and still make as a cohesive narrative? Because there were a handful of like minor pieces that didn't quite work for him the way he wanted them to. And this is such a ship in a bottle. This is such a delicate thing that if you take out one little piece, there are three or four things that also have to go with them. And then you have to perform some surgery to make that work. And he did a lot of that surgery for several months, just trying to reshape it in a way that had it hold its center.
How long was it edited for?
A long time.
5 months, six months, eight months?
I want to say like 6 months, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's unusual and that's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I know our sound recordist has a question. On the page, Ian could have felt more like a Sheldon Cooper type of character, but he didn't. And we're curious if that was casting or it was another concept.
I don't know which time I started describing this way when I introduced him on the script, but once it was there, it stayed. I described him a little bit like he dressed like a rock star, or that he just had a swagger to him that you didn't see with a scientist. And he certainly didn't have like a pocket protector or anything like that. And he loved poking people a little bit, you know, just like with, you know, verbally. Like he would get into little funny fights just to see what set somebody off. There was even more to the little argument in the script of like where, you know, it's language isn't in the corner of civilization science is. He continued saying, you don't need to know the word fire. You just need to burn someone with it.
Yeah. And you also created the heroic moment for him where he blocks her body with his own when all the guns are pointed at her. So that was great, too. We're running out of time. You, sir, in the second row. You have moments in the script where the protagonist learns that she could either change the future or be a part of it. What were the dilemmas that you were worried about with that kind of existential crisis?
Well, we had to make sure that it was just her future she could see, not everybody's. It was a case of a non-linear existence in that she didn't get to know every moment of her life all at once. She was just starting to live her life a bit more out of order. And that was probably the big takeaway that we had from it, that she wasn't really going to get to some omniscience necessarily. She would just have a greater sense of what was to come in her own life and a handful of choices that she could make to alter that.
One last question. You, sir, right here in the second row. I was going to end with that, but I'm glad you did. Do you have any desire to explore the story that is set 3,000 years into the future? Have you grafted out? Could there be a sequel called Arriving?
It's Arriving. Departures. I don't know. Is anybody from Paramount here? Like, hire me. I will write this for you guys.
But really, did you and Denny, you don't have to tell us, but did you and Denny even have that conversation, or have you even written a note card about it?
No. We were very clear about, like, let's tell the story and we're going to walk away. Like, we don't need to do, not every movie has to be a franchise movie. Let's not do that.
Good. I love it. Well, do you want to tell us anything else you're working on? I know you're adapting another story of Ted's, right? Called Understand?
Right. And that's another Invisible War all its own. You know, we're trying to make it work.
Something tells me on November 12th, you'll probably have a pretty good possibility of making it work after this movie comes out.
We'll see. I mean, we'll hope.
Anything else you want to tell us about that's long gestating or that you're working on?
I made it a pact to write one spec a year, regardless of what was going on. And I recommend that to anyone, whether they're working or not, to like do at least a spec a year.
I love this script. It's intelligent, character-driven sci-fi. Congratulations. Everybody give it up for Eric.
Thanks, guys.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Very special thanks again to today's podcast sponsor, the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship, which you can enter with your film or pilot script at www.screencraft.org. And remember to make sure to get it in by January 15th, 2017. And if you're listening to this podcast in the future, check out their site to see what other contests they're running. Of course, special thanks again to screenwriter Eric Heiserer for being so generous with his time to chat about his latest film, Arrival. This episode in the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2016. All rights reserved. And folks, I thank you again for spreading the word about issue 23 of Backstory on the iPad, and hope you'll keep an eye out for issue 24, our Manchester by the Sea issue, coming out in a week. And also letting folks know Backstory.net will become the fully functional magazine sometime soon, so keep an eye out. And hey, if you want to donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.